The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 22, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everyone. Really nice to see those of you who are here. So I just came back from the Boundary Waters. I was there for this past week. Peter, do you camp?
Yes.
Have you been to the Boundary Waters? Have you taken Mateus to the Boundary Waters? Not yet, yeah. So it's pretty remarkable place to be. It's also a pretty grueling place to be, as my husband and I discovered. So we were doing what they call double portages, which means that we packed enough stuff that we couldn't possibly all carry it one direction. So we would have to carry it one direction and then go back and then pick up the rest of it and carry it again. So every portage was three times as long as the usual portages. And our last leg, in fact, almost all the legs were like this, but the last leg, we did over 500, it was like 525 rods of portage, which means we did, 1,575 rods of portage. And it was, pretty arduous terrain that we were going on. There was one portage we were doing, and we bumped into a woman. We said, "How's the portage?" She goes, "Oh, it's kind of tricky, so hills going up and down and rocks." And so we went, and it was almost like walking on a sidewalk, and we went, "What is she talking about? We've been going up and down these hills." But anyhow, it's a beautiful place, really beautiful place. And when you come out of it and you come back into the world, the human world, there's really sort of a change. And so this is what happened for us. I will say the first thing as we were coming back to civilization was we stayed in an Airbnb that had llamas at it, and then a guy lets you walk the llamas, and we walked the llamas from one area to another. Thing about a llama, it may sound special, but the thing about a llama is, as the guy said, "Well, they're gonna chew on some grass on their way from one pen to the other," and I said, do we kind of encourage them to keep going? He goes, "I've learned you don't do tug of war with a llama." So you would just sort of let them, you were just sort of at their mercy. You'd just be at the end of the rope and they would eat grass until finally they were ready to be moved. And then that evening, so you probably looked at the schedule and you said, "Well, Mary Sullivan is supposed to be speaking today. You don't look like Mary Sullivan." And I'm clearly not Mary Sullivan. When I got out of the Boundary Waters and finally turned my phone on, which was a little more complicated than I thought because I'd had it turned off, thinking I was conserving power so that if my husband's phone, we use it for taking pictures mainly, when his phone died, that then my phone would be fresh as a daisy. But what I learned was my phone just ran out of juice. So I couldn't even quite turn it on. And when I finally got it on, I thought, I better see if there are any messages from Dharma Field. And sure enough, I saw, this was Friday night, I saw that Mary was ill and could not give the talk. And I went, "Well, I guess I'll be giving the talk on Sunday then." So on Saturday on the drive down, I was kind of sketching out what the talk would be. Now, I'm telling you all of this story because then when I was done writing this talk, and I said, "Well, it's all right, it probably could use a little more shape than it has," but I saw, we were in Minneapolis getting toward Richfield, and I saw somebody cross a bridge, and they were waving a flag, and it was I didn't know what the flag was, but I said, "I think that's Palestine," and I went, "Why is somebody waving?" It was just weird. It was just somebody waving the Palestine flag over the highway. And not 2 seconds after I saw the person waving the flag and I verified that it was a Palestine flag, my pocket vibrated from my phone. And I looked and I could see it's this chat group that I'm in. And all it was a string of expletives. And I went, "Oh my." And then I looked into our chat group and somebody responded with another string of expletives. And then I thought I better look at the New York Times because I think something has happened. And I went to the New York Times and I realized that we entered a war with Iran. So that's sort of the journey that I went on. And I thought, I don't know that I want to give my talk today. I think I would rather talk about, in light of what's been going on, right? I mean, just a week before we had that horrible violence in Minnesota. And then the next week we have us entering into a war with Iran. And it just feels like it's unsettled time, right? And then I came here and it was so hot. It was like 80 some degrees this morning. And I thought, are there even going to be any people here today at Dharma Field? And there are, I will say, and I'm very grateful for those of you who showed up. And I thought I could give a talk if you'd like. I have a talk. That's what I was working on before. I thought just in case they want the talk, I'll give the talk that I wrote, which has kind of a fun title. I'll at least tell you what the title. If I don't give it this week, this is one I give next week because I'll be giving the talk next week as well. And that talk is titled Living Out of Our Dreams. And it actually has something to do with what we'll probably be discussing today. Or I thought I'd give you the option, if you wanted to, just sort of talk about your feelings about what's going on right now, where you're at, and the place that this practice has in this world, what it is we're doing. So I thought it would be nice maybe to have this conversation, but I'll leave it to you. Do you want to talk? Would you like to do that? Should we talk? So what I think we could do, because we're so small, it seems to me ridiculous that we should be spread out all across this window. And there's only two of us on cushions, so we can hop up in chairs too. And maybe if we can, do you mind reconfiguring the room a little bit? And we'll do like a circle around that. Is that okay? Yeah, I know. And I won't be able to hear them if we keep it at this configuration. It definitely will just be like, and then all it will sound like, and that's my ears problems, not necessarily our tech problems. And I am seeing somebody about this. So I went to an audiologist in April. In April, just to verify that, yeah, my hearing is pretty bad. And I have an idea what some of it is. And they said, so we'll schedule you to see if you can get that surgery that'll correct some of your hearing problem. Might be a few months out. Well, it's in September. So, and that's just to say, yep, you can have the surgery. So then I'll probably be months beyond that. And then after that's when they determine if I'm going to need, well, I know I'm going to need a hearing aid, but what that's going to look like. So it could be up to about a year before all that's taken care of. So I do apologize, but if we can get in a circle and talk to one another, I would think that'd be great. Let's clear some of these cushions out of the way here.
Oh, so move it deeper into the room. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Affordable bills.
What was that?
You gonna bow out over there still?
Yeah, we'll do the usual bowing
Okay.
and such.
No, this is a big deal.
I'll go sit back down, yeah. Thanks.
And then you've got a clock on you, so you can kind of keep time.
Okay.
All right. So I guess we just want to check in. How are you all doing? I mean, it seems pretty tumultuous.
I'll go.
Yeah.
I didn't even know we had gone to war with Iran because I haven't been off. I kind of been off the news, and we have a neighbor. I mentioned this at Rick's talk on Wednesday. I have a really good friend, neighbor around the bend, who's got two young kids. He's my age. And we found out on Tuesday that he went to go work out and had an aneurysm and passed away almost instantly.
Holy cow.
So that was, it was very, very, upsetting. And, you know, we've been trying to figure out how to help his wife and kids and stuff. So it's been like trying to navigate that with everything else that's going on and trying to figure, like, I just really been struggling with like it just to be present, you know, to just be present for them, what they need. And I always feel like that's not enough. Like I always have to add, like you have to do something or help them or you're trying to figure out, you know, the subconscious probably trying to figure out like why did it happen? Because if you could figure that out, which you never will, like that how gives you some peace of mind, like, you know, it could, because it could equally happen, could have happened to me.
In a way, similar kind of thing. Life shows up in really surprising ways. And then maybe we think, how do I avoid that? But yeah, thanks for sharing. Yeah, stuff like that as well can be very upsetting. You know, family or friends, you know, having issues. So, yeah, David.
So I've been a pacifist since I turned graphics.
Just one quick question. Can people hear us online, all of us?
Yeah.
It's thumbs up. I'm going to get a cup of water here. I'm a little dry.
Yeah. And I had it easy because I was a Methodist minister's son, and there was a paragraph in the Methodist rule book that said that the church supported conscientious objectors. So I had no trouble with my draft board. You know, I've had friends who had to flee to Canada and Sweden and places like that, but I had no trouble at all. Then when I dropped out of college and became eligible for the draft, I thought I'd be changing bedpans at some VA hospital. The Secretary of Defense abolished the draft before I actually got all the way called up. I mean, I'd already gotten notice to show up for a physical, but I didn't have to do anything. So I lucked out. But it's always difficult in situations like this to remember that I'm a pacifist. So the pacifist point of view is that war is never the answer. Never the answer. And I haven't done a study of it, and I have this vague sense that the Buddhists, when after a thousand years of living in India and Hinduism became really resurgent and began to resent Buddhism, the Buddhists just left. They went to other places. There aren't that many Buddhists in India anymore. They didn't want to fight the Hindus. They just left. So there's that, if it's true. But Friday night, I'm sitting here in meditation thinking about Vance Belter. Okay, let go. And it's tough. It's tough. I'm not surprised that Trump did this. But ACO Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, this is an impeachable offense. Right on, Ocasio. It won't happen unless Democrats take majority in the House and a supermajority in the Senate. But anyway.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, again, thinking about these things that seem to be out of our control and how we, you know, the way you're thinking, you know, that anger that we have toward individuals, particular individuals, and watching that anger showing up, but also the desire to want to control something and to make something different. It's not, we're going to just be very careful here. It's not that what I'm going to say is that we don't do something like that and try to do something about it, but just look at that's, how do I avoid getting an aneurysm? Maybe there was something he did that I, you know, and then we think, well, how do, what conditions that don't exist right now can we try to make happen so that this other thing, right? So it's just something to notice, right? It's not something to judge. It's not something to say, I'm bad for doing that. It's just to go, oh no, look what I'm doing here. You know, so I just thought it was interesting that both of you had that as sort of the tail end of your descriptions of these wolves that we encountered. Yeah. So there's somebody online. Who is it?
Mike
Wallace?
Yes. Okay. Yes. well, I too spent last week up north, most of it, but not in the boundary waters. But anyway, with the violence last week and now Trump bombing Iran, you know, I just wanted to pull the covers over my head. I wanted to go back to bed. And I thought, oh, I just can't, you know, this constant turmoil. I just can't go on like this. This is crazy. And so, yeah, I'm hurting. That's all.
Okay. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, Peter.
Thanks. So yesterday, in our family, it was a really kind of bonkers day. My elder son, he's 16, he's traveling by himself in Nashville. And we had, I don't want to bore you with the whole story, but he had a whole mess with flight delays, missed connections. So he's going to South Africa. Yeah. Thank you. So my wife and I were on the phone or on the laptop all day yesterday, you know, talking to two different airlines, trying to find alternative routes to get him there. Lost luggage. Anyway, he is in route now. He's fine. You know, it worked out. When his bag gets there, it's a different story, but he's fine. But sort of in the midst of all that, 9 o'clock or whatever time it was last night, it was like this news thing pops up that, you know, we bombed Iran. So I've been in favor of that, kind of with all the sort of the context, kind of all the circumstances. I do think it's the right call. Having said that, you know, I remember being in favor of the invasion of Iraq 20 years ago, and that was obviously turned out to be kind of a disaster. So, you know, I try to bear that in mind. Things, it's easy to get in, sometimes very, very hard to get out. And it is people's lives, and, you know, it is horrible even when it's the right thing to do. So just trying to sort of keep in mind, for myself, it's trying to remember kind of the full picture.
Yeah, yeah.
Not getting too locked in on just what my side thinks or, you know, how I want it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So war is, you know, there was a something that Katagiri said that I heard in this context of somebody who used to come to Dharma Field. He lives up in near Bayfield, Wisconsin. If people know where that is, it's way up by Lake Superior. He kind of lives in the middle of the woods now. And he was talking about how he helps his neighbor, basically. I don't know what you call it, harvest chickens. I mean, I don't know what you do when you're ready to slaughter the chickens. And he was talking about this machine that they had to defeather the chickens. And just You just take the chicken and shake it. And he goes, you pull it out and most of the feathers would be gone then. And then you're just finished plucking the chicken. And you know, all of us listening to the story were a little horrified by what he was describing. And he said, yeah, I remember Katagiri saying, meat is messy. And I thought, wow, that's pretty deep. You know, I really did. I thought that was a great teaching. And I think the same is true of war. You know, war is messy. And to remember that maybe we do have to engage in it. It's hard to say. You know, I certainly don't, for people for whom war is just not the answer. I respect that perspective. You know, but perhaps it is the answer, but we got to remember that. It's messy. It's messy. So I appreciate your saying that, Peter. You know, it's a little easier if we don't have skin in the game, but once we seem to have skin in the game, and for us, that almost seems to mean that we know somebody who's involved. It's a little easy not to be disengaged from it. You know, I remember one of the wars we were in where we were told to continue shopping. It just felt so removed from what was going on that it was startling to hear. But
Go ahead, Mary.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I'm thinking. You know, we have been shooting down the Houthis down by the canal who are attacking our ships, but we didn't call it war. And what I saw in the paper and all over the news media is the New York Times, we are at war. Okay. Really, if you, it's kind of a conceptualization because in actuality, we just shot down some nuclear capability. We didn't declare war. And what AOC said is he didn't have the authority to declare war without them, but all he did was destroy some nuclear capability that was being used to threaten us and Israel. And, you know, I always thought if we just left them alone, it'd be okay, you know, that they probably wouldn't really do anything. And so I have so many mixed feelings about this. I'm not jumping into the idea that we're at war, because I don't know that we're at war. It hasn't been declared, but somehow the media has taken this on as, well, they looked up the definition of war and decided we're at war. I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Well, thank you, Mary. Yeah, I mean, there you go. So it's very possible that somebody can counter, you know, what you just said and start talking about why it is somebody might do that. Just hold on though. Because I think that, you know, one of the difficulties that we're expressing here is that idea of ideas. I don't know how else to put it, but that we'll have definitions that this is war and this isn't war. And as you're pointing out, we were shooting down other things. Other people were being injured and it wasn't being declared war. And there could be reasons for that, right? So we want to start getting caught up again. And that I think we do. We got to get caught. Was this war? Is this not war? Is this something to be outraged about? Is this something not to be outraged about? Is this something to, that's our life, right? This is where life unfolds, right? Where we have sides that we take. We have explanations. We have definitions, we have all of that stuff. And you know what? That's what my talk was going to be about. That's the dream I was talking about. And I'll talk about this next week. This is just how we put the world together. This is how we dream the world. And everybody does it. Everybody does it. And everybody's going to have a different dream of the world. The way that they, by dreaming the world, I mean the way we put the world together. Like how we imagine what this world is and our dreams, the way we might think of it is our hopes and aspirations for this world, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And that's our world, that we have a world with everybody has their dreams and aspirations, and can we live in that world and allow people to have them? I think that's where it really gets hard, because somebody's dreams of the world might be very different from mine. Very, very different from mine. Right? And then when I say that, does that mean that when we see harm being inflicted, that we're just passive and quiet? I don't know. So that's part of my question, is what is this practice in this world? And what is this? So anyhow, I don't know, David, did you have something to add?
And in response to Mary, the Iranians think we're at war. You know, they think we have declared war on them. But the Buddhist story about this is when a neighboring kingdom declared war on Shakyamuni's birthplace kingdom. And so he went there and he sat on the road, beside the road where the invading army was coming, underneath a dead tree. And it was hot. And it was so unusual a sight that the invading general stopped and asked him what he was doing, sitting under a dead tree. And he said, even a dead tree is something that can be appreciated in the land that one loves. And he touched the invading general, and he turned around and left. But there were plenty of other people who were talking war in his ear. So he chased the Buddha again and invaded again. And this time the Buddha didn't hear about it in time. And he watched the invading army engage with his own kinfolk, you know, from the hilltop. And his disciples were saying, can't you do something? He said, no, there's nothing that can be done at this point. There's nothing that can be done. You take care of it when you can, and when there's nothing you can do, you just have to wait. But that's our practice, in answer to your question. We take care of the world as best we can, when we can, and when there's nothing that can be done, you just have to wait until there is something that can be done.
Okay.
One thing I've been really struggling with in just recent global events is, you know, how are we supposed to approach talking to people, talking about peace, you know, aiming for these lofty ideals of solving the conflict and whatever that looks like, when, you know, the other side, quote unquote, other people that we're encountering, not even on a side, are so holding so tightly to their conceptions of things. You know, they're in their delusion or whatever. They're really gripping on to whatever they believe in, that it feels like you're talking to a brick wall. You know, how do you go about, you know, like being open-minded about that and trying to have an actual effective conversation? And I mean that here in the U.S. with political parties, different religious viewpoints, but also, you know, in Israel and Gaza, you know, because this is happening all in that conversation of what's going on there. You know, seeing, especially last week before what happened last night, when Iran was attacking Israel, I was seeing a lot of stuff online of like Israelis being like, oh, I'm being, you know, put in a bunker. I'm afraid, even in my apartment. And my immediate reaction was, well, this is directly mirroring what was being said by Gazan citizens and other Palestinians. And so it's this big mirror being put in front of them of, this is what you were doing, and not, you know, general citizens, but their government. And I'm not saying like they deserve it, not at all. But it's happening in conversation with what's going on in Gaza. So then you're putting this mirror in front of them and no one's really seeming to take anything away or learn anything from this. And how, like, how are you supposed to navigate these conversations when it feels like you're just hitting a wall on the other side?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. How are you listening to the wall would be the question I would ask. You know, so for us, the way we see it is I talk to these people and they don't listen at all. But are you listening to the wall? What does the wall say? So how does a conversation work? You know, do we talk at each other or do we speak with one another? And I think, you know, we think about the precepts, and the precepts really are a great guide to how we live life. They're not rules, you know, and I know we've pointed that out in the past. They're not rules. And I think some of the violence we're seeing isn't because people are taking the precepts as rules, but it's what happens when you take moral, teachings or whatever, and you make them into rules. Then if things don't adhere to the rules, then they're wrong, right? Then they have to be put back in line again. But we think about precepts and how they help us to see how we're clinging to something that is not allowing all of this just to be what it is, which is, as we've just been talking about, very difficult for all the reasons we've just been talking about. And again, you know, I pointed us toward the big stuff, but we know the little stuff actually hurts us probably even more. You know, that the stuff, it can be, what is the Mel Brooks joke? It's, you know, comedy. Is he? Yeah, comedy is a guy walking down the street and he falls down the sewer. You know, those old comedy routines where the sewer would be removed from the road and the guy would fall down. You know what I'm talking about? Like the round sewer tops in the street. Yeah, so comedy is a guy walks down the street, falls down the sewer. Tragedy is I get a paper cut. You know what I mean? Like the stuff that affects us right in our immediate life is the stuff that really impacts us. But if we start looking, we can see that all of it kind of has the same flavor. It's a little different. You know, we can see there are differences between, say, war and, I don't know, the fact that this one's going to sound ridiculous, but maybe your partner always puts the toilet seat down and you're telling him, keep the toilet seat up, right? And that becomes this point of aggravation. But I think about Suzuki once being asked, how do wars start? I think it was the question. And he just pointed at two meditation mats are brushed up against one another. And I think one of them maybe went a little over the top of the other. And I said, right there, that's how war starts. All right, so thinking again about your questions, it's like, are we listening to the wall? And the precept of right speech has within it listening, right listening. And right listening is really hard. You know, I read a book last summer. I think it was last summer. It was called Doppelganger. It was by Naomi Klein. And she had in there this conversation about COVID and about the sides that were kind of taking place and the debates about how best to move forward with COVID. And we all know this just went like this. And it was like, this is the way to do it. No, this is the way to do it. And then if you weren't in this camp, then there was something wrong with you. And if you weren't in this camp, then there was something wrong with you. And there was a lot of fighting going on about that. And she acknowledged now that some of the ideas that she initially just threw back as offensive and as harmful as perhaps they were good ideas, but she couldn't hear them at the time because she was too busy being in her camp. You know what I mean? Like that was the other side was saying this. Well, the other side was saying a bunch of bozo nonsense. So they're going to say this, then this is something it's just garbage. And it didn't even get the time of day. This is who's the wall. You know what I mean? Like you can't get that other side to listen to you. Well, don't listen either. So I think that's a great question, Kaylee. And I do think it's something we want to keep asking yourself.
Yeah, questions.
Wow, I'm having like this huge visceral reaction. Yeah. Like my whole body right now is like tingling, and I don't know, like one part of me wants to cry. One part of me wants to pick up my chair and just ram it against the wall.
Yeah.
So I think that as humans, like there's this thing and it's called intuitive rightness. I believe that like at our core, like we know, right? We know it's ineffable. We just know it, right? And so like I can go out there and I can like blame. But at the end of the day, that's not, I can't worry about that. What I got to worry about is right here. And right here is, I have a choice. I know what intuitive rightness is. I have a choice. And the choice is, do I know better, but do worse? And when I see that I sometimes do worse when I know better, then I can cut other people some slack and know that they've freaking really messed up. And then if I know that they messed up, then I know that we all do that. And then we, that gives like sort of takes away that like heaviness and just it, like enables like hope and, you know, sort of something better for the future. Because if I know better and do better next time, right, then I'm like, I'm shooting that out into the world. And when everything feels out of control and I hate everything that I see out of my eyes, the only thing that I can do is just embrace it and just like send love. And right, I know that sounds like really stupid, but I am a person in an ecosystem that contains multitudes and multitudes. And if I can send that out into, then I think that's how I have the impact on what's bigger in the world. And so this is really upsetting to me because like that's all I can do. Like that's all I can do.
Yeah.
And that feels really good. And then what else I can do if I really feel like shit? So I go outside and I go listen to the birds and I go find a beautiful flower and I go hug my mom because she's still alive. And I watch somebody laugh or, you know, whatever. And then I know that it's all okay. We have been killing and shooting everybody since time beginning. This is what we humans do. But again, we know better. And if we know better and do worse, then there's always a chance that we can know better and do better. And that means we can give everybody else the chance to do that too as well.
Yeah. What you just described is my talk, basically, that I heard. But stated in a very wonderful way. So thank you for sharing. That's absolutely right. Now, this is a teaching you'll hear at Dharmafield is watch your own mind, which sounds like it's losing the love aspect of it. But that's really what it is when we're not doing that. And I actually have a passage from the Dhammapada that I want to read at some point. I don't know what time we're getting to be, but I totally hear what you're saying. I think that's kind of what Kaylee, you were expressing too, that frustration that we know what's right. We do know. I totally agree with you. That's, we know, but we lose track of it. We really do. And it's real easy to lose track. We all do that. When we were camping, I had to really watch my mind. I don't know. Mateus, you go camping at all?
Yeah.
And sometimes things don't go right. Yeah. And then does somebody get crabby when things don't go right? I know I get crabby. And I had to watch myself and I've gone, well, this can't be fun for my husband. You know what I mean? For me to be going, bah, 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 bah. You know, I was like going, wow. So I apologized to him. I just said, I know I'm being crabby. And part of that's just anxiety because we just, you know, humped a canoe and three packs over things that were, you know, slippery rocks and mud. And you think, what happens if I break my ankle out in the middle of the boundary? You know what I mean? Like, so I said, that's all that stuff is showing up as crabbiness, but that crabbiness is just us doing the thing that we get frustrated because we know that we all know. We know we all know. And then we lose track of it and we want people to do better. But the way to not do it is to try to get them to change that, to grab them. But it's to do what Kristen was saying, which is to just, you can do what you said, it's all I can do is send that out. But it's all we can do. I mean, it's an amazing thing. What we can do is just be open. Let people make mistakes, so to speak. Let people be where they're at. And then we live that. That's the world. You know, everybody has their dream of the world. And we can love that. And we can struggle with that. And we can, you know what I mean? Like, but that is the nature of the world. What we can do is just accept it. And in that acceptance, there is a lightness to this. That once you see the taking side stuff is so, you know, and being able to, like I said, when Naomi Klein talked about being able to listen to the other side, I knew exactly what she was talking about. Because I remember during COVID, it kind of got scary when people had certain views and you'd be like, no, that's not right. If you do that, death and terrible, right? You know what I mean? It was just like, it was the stakes for life and death. And it seemed to me, and I'm not saying I'm right, I'm just saying at the time when I was getting freaked out, it felt like not everybody was taking those stakes that way, that they were thinking that the stakes were different. You know? So again, I was just coming at it without allowing everybody to have their own perspective. And once you do that, including yourself, because that's then you can let yourself off the hook, so to speak, because we all do this. But we can live a life where we start to be more attentive to everything that's going on, everything, including our own prejudices and allowing people to just be where they're coming from, but to see where we're coming from, to be able to see that. That's what we can't always do, right? We lose track of how we've dreamed the world up. We lose track of that. And once we lost track of that, it becomes a little harder to see it. So our practice is really just to be here, to be this. And this is that love. It's right here. Everything. You know, Norm would say things are, you know, mutually assisting one another. And it seems impossible when that world is, shows up like this. But if you can see what Norm's talking about, if you can allow all of this to be, is it to see that it's all working together, it kind of takes some of the weight off of it. And it really truly does. What time have we got right now?
Yeah, 10:44.
10:45, all right.
We have one more comment from Mary online.
Yeah.
You know, something that troubled me in this, first of all, I would say, when this happened, I just didn't know what to think. You know? I just looked at it, I was confused by it. But what hurt me most is when I heard that the United States military had sent blood, units to the area where the United States Army or whatever troops were in the Middle East, with the idea that their own troops were going to suffer and need blood as a result of what Trump did. And this is just, I mean, this is one that's hard for me. I mean, yes, it's good that they're not going to provide blood and just let them die, but to take that risk with our own people, who are just sitting targets in the Middle East or Iran. It just, I don't know, it made me, chilled me or something.
Yeah, I understand that. It's okay. You know what I mean? It's okay to get angry. It's okay to be afraid. That's part of it. That's part of the contract. That's part of being human.
Well, I don't know if it's afraid, but it's kind of revulsion that they're there and basically we're going to, you know, we made them into sitting ducks. And I think I'm not afraid really, but it's like a collateral damage that's planned that's human life. I don't know. I just thought that's it.
Yeah.
I read this book last summer. I don't know if I recommend it because it was horrifying, but it was one of the best books I've ever read in my entire life. And it was called Nuclear War, a Scenario. Mm-hmm. And it's written by a woman who worked for, I think she was worked for the Wall Street Journal, but she was like an investigative journalist, and she had interviewed, because all this stuff is confidential, like nuclear armament and what we have and what they have. But she had done all this research and interviewed people who were not like retired military. And she basically, the whole book is a reconstruction of what could happen if there was a first, what like there's a term for it, but like a first launch. And it was, to me, it was almost, and I say this with all concern, it was almost comical in what, in the sense that there was so much human foible and error and ego involved in the whole thing. And then pretty much at the end of it, we're all gone because yeah. One person hits a button and the other person doesn't know what happened. So they hit their button. And then you throw in the fact that people who have nuclear weapons also don't have the capability to determine whether it's an actual attack or, you know, they talked about some of these countries have technology that's so outdated that they can't tell whether it's a nuclear missile or a flock of geese, you know, and then those kinds. So then they launch, and once you launch, you can't unlaunch. So it was just, you know, you're just like, well, you know, as soon as that first one goes, you know, it's like, and it just made me, you know, realize like how fragile everything is based on this human ego and desire and fear. And it made me think of that, which I've never been able to find anywhere published or written on the internet or anything, that quote that Steve or Hagen or Norm mentioned about Yasutani Roshi's quote about, even if a nuclear bomb goes off on my head, it's my reality expressing itself through my life. I'm not saying it correctly, but you know the quote.
Reality does not get destroyed or something. Like
yeah, that. Yeah. It's reality is manifesting completely in that moment.
It's pithier than that. But
yeah. I'm butchering it. But to me, that brings me right back, because to have that, to no matter what's showing up, to have that, to see that, as Yasutani did, you know, because in that moment, you know, there's so much, fear and desire, and I don't want this to happen, and, you know, and,
Well, think about your friend with the aneurysm, right? One of the things we think is we have an allotted amount of time on the planet, unless there's some reason why we might not think we do. But even then, we might have an idea of what that allotted time is. And then we live our life thinking that that's our allotted time on the planet. Right. So Gregory Corso, one of the beat poets, wrote a poem called, I think it was called The Bomb, and it's shaped like a mushroom cloud. So it goes on for several pages long, and it's just a celebration of the hydrogen bomb. It's a joyous celebration of the hydrogen bomb, because to him, the hydrogen bomb just brings to light the fact that we could die at any second. And this life is happening right now, right? Rather than thinking about parceling it out and saying, well, I got 20 more years, you die at any second. Now, that might be a little glib to say that, but that was what his poem was about. And I think about, you know, the comedy and tragedy you're talking about. That's what happened with Dr. Strangelove. It was supposed to be a thriller, supposed to be scary. And as Kubrick was working on it, it just seemed so ludicrous. The whole thing just seemed so farcical that he decided to make it a comedy instead. Because how else could you see this? You know, comedy, tragedy. It's hard to parse the difference out. I think we're going to...
10:50. Yeah.
10:50. I think we're going to wrap up. I just wanted to read a passage from the Dhammapada. It's a lovely passage. It has some bearing on what we're talking about. And it's right at the beginning of the book, you know, and I'm reading this translation, even though it's maybe not the most literal translation, but there's a loveliness. This is Eknath Iswaran's translation. There's a loveliness, his translation, that I actually do like. You're going to know this. I'm going to read it from the beginning because there's a few verses in addition to what I was going to read you, but this whole opening section, and I think it kind of gets at a lot of what we've been talking about today. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfish thoughts cause misery when they speak or act. Sorrows roll over them as the wheels of a cart roll over the tracks of the bullock that draws it. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. We are formed and molded by our thoughts. Those whose minds are shaped by selfless thoughts give joy whenever they speak or act. Joys follow them like a shadow that never leaves them. He insulted me, he struck me, he cheated me, he robbed me. Those caught in resentful thoughts never find peace. He insulted me, he struck me, he cheated me, he robbed me. Those who give up resentful thoughts surely find peace. For hatred does not cease by hatred at any time. Hatred ceases by love. This is the unalterable law. I think those are really wise words that are appropriate to, you know, what we're living right now. So words to keep in mind. I want to thank you all for being here. We'll wrap this up, and I'll be back next week to give a talk. So buckle in. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.